Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. So we had an excellent review talk on Tuesday concerning the connection between cosmic rays and supernova remnants. And today, my goal is to review the constraints that can be provided by gamma ray observations of supernova remnants. So I will go straight to the point, since we had so many introduction of cosmic ray physics this morning. So we all know that electrons are being accelerated by supernova remnants, and these electrons radiate extremely efficiently by synchrotron emission, Bremsstrahlung, and inverse quantum scattering. But these electrons only constitute 1% of the cosmic ray particles. So 99% of the cosmic rays are protons and heavier elements. So these are the particles that you really want to pinpoint. And to find the accelerator of protons, there is one way. There are several ways, but one way is offered by gamma ray observations, since these protons will interact with the matter surrounding the accelerator, producing gamma rays. And that's why we've got this usual game of trying to disentangle the gamma rays produced by the electrons through Bremsstrahlung and inverse quantum scattering, for instance, by the gamma rays produced by the protons, since these are the particles that we really want to pinpoint. So to explain our game with a sort of sketch, this is the usual SED that we've seen so many times for supernova remnants, with the synchrotron emission that extends from the radio up to the X-rays. And in the gamma ray, you've got all this mass with a peaky inverse Compton scattering emission, a sort of flatter Bremsstrahlung, although it depends on the particle spectrum, and a proton-proton interaction there. So it's really a sketch just to show you what we're doing with ANT. And you see that if you cover the whole energy range with satellites and Cherenkov telescopes, then you will be able to disentangle between the protons and the electrons. So that's really qualitative. Let's be a bit more quantitative. So as an example, I'm using here a plot made by Daniel Castro and collaborators to really show you the ratios between the different radiative processes. So what he has done is model a supernova remnant with an injection of 10 to the 51 erg, which is the typical energy for a supernova. Then you let it evolve, and you assume as a photon field the CMB, and you put 1% of electron per proton, which is a standard galactic value. And then if you look at the ratio of inverse Compton to proton-proton, so gamma rays from these two, or Bremsstrahlung to proton-proton, then you see that for a density of 1 per cubic centimeter, you've got a ratio close to 1, but as soon as you will have a higher density of 10 or 100, which is the basic densities of supernova remnants interacting with molecular clouds, then your ratio will be much higher. So the proton-proton will clearly dominate over inverse Compton. For what concerns Bremsstrahlung, you see directly that the Bremsstrahlung needs a very high electron-to-proton ratio to push this ratio up. So you need at least 10 times more electrons than the usual value to have the Bremsstrahlung dominate over proton-proton. So that's the a bit more quantitative so that you can understand what I will present in the following. So, and in the following, I will start, of course, with this nice picture. You've seen it several times, but it will help me to help you understand why it's so hard to catch the protons. So we've got two excellent examples of a supernova remnant for which we are sure, thanks to the gamma ray emission, that we're seeing the protons. Why are we sure that for these two we're seeing the protons? Everything is located in the low energy band. Everything is located below 300 MeV. And that's why it's so hard to find the proton accelerator. So that's IC443 and W44. You see the Fermi spectral point there, and the prediction for proton-proton interaction is this solid line. Then the dotted line is the prediction for Bremsstrahlung. And you see that they are almost equivalent up to 300 MeV. And at 300 MeV, the proton-proton interaction follows perfectly the Fermi point, and again for W44, whereas the Bremsstrahlung overshoot the flux that we get with Fermi. But in this energy band, the diffuse background that we have is huge, and our effective area deteriorates. So that's really hard, and that's why we've got so few examples of supernova remnants for which we see this pine bum feature, as we call it. The nice thing with IC443 is that we can go even further. We've got a supernova that evolves in a very inhomogeneous environment, and since it is extended at GV and TV energies, we can try to resolve it and do spectra in different regions. So it was presented already several times. IC443 has a very dense, is located in very varying amount of target material with a dense CO cloud there and fast atomic shock in this region. So I hope you've seen the poster by Brian Umensky, but here I will summarize some of the main results. So first, the Veritas collaboration looked at this source in 2007 with 38 hours of data, and then improved the result in 2015 with almost 180 hours on source, plus an upgrade on their photomultipliers, plus the displacement of the telescope one, which increased their sensitivity. They obtained a very nice significance map on IC443, showing that they are able to resolve the morphology of the supernova remnant. They then triggered the Fermi collaboration to have a look at this source and see if we are able also to resolve the morphology. And here is what the Fermi collaboration obtained. This is a TS map, so it's really a sort of significance map, which is extremely well in correlation with the Veritas significance map. And if you superimpose the Veritas contours on the Fermi TS map, you see that they perfectly match. Another thing to see on this picture is that the Fermi TS map, but also the Veritas significance map, of course, since they are in agreement, have a very good correspondence with dense CO clouds, which can be also seen with shocked HCO material traced by HCO+. But we are not only seeing the dense material, we are seeing emission from the wall remnant, as you can see, with this contour from radio emission. We see all the remnant up to the north, although there is not so much dense matter in this region. So the next step was to try to get spectra in these different regions for which we've got different material. So Fermi and Veritas work together in these four different regions. It is reported in the poster by Brian. Please go and see it and ask him questions about that. And here are the four different spectra. In particular, you can see the spectra in red from this very dense CO region. And this one, where we don't have so much dense matter, in blue, which is the faintest. But it seems that there is just a sort of scaling. So the spectral shape, at least at gamma ray energies, doesn't seem to change significantly. And we always see a sort of a broken polo with a break at about 60 GeV. And that's really interesting because it's the first time we can resolve such a supernova remnant with such a varying environmental condition. Let's move on to another target, which was very often cited during this conference, and it's the case of W49B. At gamma ray energies, it is interesting because we know that it is interacting with the molecular cloud and that we've got dense matter so that the protons can interact with this matter and produce gamma rays. But it's also interesting because it is known to be relatively young, although the age is uncertain. It could be young between 1 and 4 kilo years. So it's detected at radio. You can see in pink the radial shell. It is centrally filled in X-rays. You know it since it was already said several times. But it's also detected in infrared. And a flux estimate show that there is no spectral break from the radio to the infrared energies. And it's detected at TV and GV energies. So since supernova remnant interacting with molecular clouds that are relatively faint at TV energies, that's one extremely interesting source for which we can have constraints from the TV range. And here is the multi-wavelength data. You see the radio range, the infrared point, the Fermi point, and the TV point. And at first eye, you can directly see that, again, we sort of see this pan-bump feature, although it's less significant than 4W44 and IC443. But again, it seems to be a sort of hadronic, a proton accelerator. So let's see if we can really prove that with simple model. Simple model meaning you inject mostly protons and you let them radiate, so you've got an electron-to-proton ratio of 0.01. And then you can see that varying the spectral, the injection spectrum, you can still fit perfectly the whole multi-wavelength data with different densities, so from 1.8 up to 2.2 in green. And the leptonic dominated, meaning that you put an electron-to-proton ratio of 1, which is extremely high, and you try to reproduce the multi-wavelength data. And at first eye, you see that you overshoot the Fermi flux at low energy, and you underpredict the infrared flux. If you increase the density a bit, up to 1,000 per cubic centimeter, it's a bit better, but still you need a very hard injection spectrum of 1.8 if you want to not to contradict with the Fermi upper limit at low energy. So all that seems to really favor the hadronic scenario in a dense medium again for this source. Just like to mention one other interesting point for W49B. I won't cover the reacceleration process so much since it will be certainly discussed by Martina in this session, but you've got two possible ways to produce a gamma ray. Either you reaccelerate and compress the galactic sea of cosmic rays in your cloud, or you have a fresh acceleration and compression of particles at the shock. And if you look at the surface brightness at gamma ray energies and in radio, these are the different W51C, W44, IC443 are all located in this bunch of points, whereas W49B and G349 are located as outliers with a very high lat flux, which imply a very high cosmic ray density. And in this case, maybe it was claimed by some authors, and in particular Yasunobu, that reacceleration may not be enough. And in this case, we would see freshly accelerated cosmic rays, which would be extremely interesting. So everything during this part was about supernova remnant interacting directly with a shock, with a molecular cloud with a shock. But we can have protons accelerated at the supernova remnant that will then escape and diffuse and then interact with the surrounding molecular cloud, and by proton-proton interaction will produce gamma rays. So this molecular cloud will be bright at gamma ray energies. And of course, your cosmic rays won't diffuse everywhere. Usually they diffuse along the XMOB field direction, and in some condition you could even have a sort of bipolar morphology depending on the density that you have surrounding your cosmic ray accelerator. So we've tested this option by looking at W44 is one of the two for which we are sure that we are seeing the protons with IC443. So here is the gamma, the count map as seen by Fermi between 2 and 100 GeV. If you subtract the emission from the supernova remnant, Assuming the radio spatial template, here is the residual map that we get above 2 GeV, and you can see directly two very bright blobs of emission surrounding the supernova remnant in each side, which seem to be in line with the scenario of particle escape. So let's see if energetically it is plausible. We know that WE44 is surrounded by a giant molecular cloud complex. So it is really feasible that indeed cosmic rays escaping from WE44 would interact with this giant molecular cloud complex. We know the size and the mass of this complex from molecular observation. It's 100 parsec with a mass of 10 to the 6 solar masses. Knowing, having a model to reproduce the flux of WE44, we can then let our protons escape and diffuse and solve the diffusion equation using this diffusion coefficient. We vary this parameter D28 between 0.1 and 3, and the kinetic energy channeled into cosmic rays that we need to put to reproduce the flux of source 1 plus source 2, these two bright spots, is between 0.3 to 3 times 10 to the 50 erg. So it's about 3% to 30% of the energy of a supernova. So that's really reasonable, and that would be in line with the fact that supernova remnant would accelerate cosmic rays. So all this part was about very bright supernova remnant at GeV energies, very fine supernova remnants at TeV energies, and they're all located here in this diagram. I will now go with fainter objects at GeV energies, brighter objects at TeV energies, and I will do a transition from this case to this case with the case of Puppis 8. So that's really an interesting object, just because it is really a transition case, as you will see. It is a well-defined supernova remnant with a distance of about 2.2 kiloparsec, an age of 3,700 years, so it is in the set of Taylor phase, and we've got a central compact object identified that can further constrain the age and the distance. And it is located in a well-known environment, so it evolves in the ISM, but very close to a molecular cloud. You see here the CO contours in red, and it's starting to interact in some small clumps. One is located here in green. So this image is the Fermi TS map that we get on Puppis A. It's relatively bright, and the contours come from ROSAT. So there is a very good correspondence between the Fermi TS map and the ROSAT contours. So we've gathered multi-wavelength data on Puppis A from radio and GeV energies. At the time of the publication of the Fermi paper, the Hess upper limits were not published yet. I have just superimposed on our plot the Hess upper limits that have been published last year. So let's try with our end again to see what constraint would come from an inverse Compton-dominated model. So you try to reproduce gamma rays by inverse Compton, mainly by inverse Compton. Of course, the other processes play a role, but less significant, by Bremsstrahlung-dominated or by proton-proton. If you want the inverse Compton to dominate, of course, you need to suppress the Bremsstrahlung and the proton-proton. And the only way to suppress these two is to have a very low density. So your density needs to be lower than 0.3 per cubic centimeter, which is much lower than what the infrared and X-ray studies imply, since it's 10 times lower. Then to have, again, your Bremsstrahlung dominate over proton-proton is the usual thing. You need a very high electron-to-proton ratio, up to 1. But except that, the Bremsstrahlung and the proton-proton do have the same issue. And the issue comes from this one-zone model, which is obviously too simple, as it was stated several times during this conference. The first issue comes from this point. Maybe you don't really see it, but it's an upper limit that we have obtained using WMAP data. And if it is confirmed, it is a two-sigma effect, then it's clear that none of our model will be able to reproduce such a break. The second issue is the Emacs. For all these models to reproduce the turnover that was visible with Fermi, but it's even more visible with the Hess upper limit now that we have them, we need an energy max of 500 GeV or 800 GeV, depending on the model, but it's extremely low for such a young remnant. So the only idea that we got to explain such a low energy maximum energy was to say that, well, the supernova remnant is already interacting with the molecular cloud, and maybe the acceleration has ceased. But the interaction is only localized, whereas we see the whole remnant, so that's really puzzling. That's really puzzling, and that leads me to one major ingredient. If you take home just one message about gamma ray energies and supernova remnants, it's really everything comes from the location of your remnant. If you want to constrain the flux, the maximum energy, the fraction of particles that will become cosmic rays, everything depends on the location. And I'm using this slide from Damiano to really highlight this important point. Let's move on to younger shell types of supernova remnants. So we've got five shell types of supernova remnants detected by Hess, and the top three are detected by Fermi. So RX-13, Vela Junior, RCW86. I should say that there is a marginal detection of SN106 at 4 sigma, which still needs to be confirmed. So there is a poster on Vela Junior by Yuri. I encourage you to have a look at this poster. I won't explain all these candidates, and I will only present the case of RCW86. So this one is also extremely interesting because there were several papers saying that it is a very efficient accelerator, at least on the northern region. So we have detected this source at TV and GV energies, and the second thing is that it is controversial, but most recent papers said that it should be associated to the historical supernova 185, which constrains the age at 1,850 years. So here is the Fermi TS map, and in comparison with the contours is the radio contour, the XMM thermal X-rays, the XMM non-thermal X-rays, and the Hess contour. I didn't put all the numbers, but just to summarize, the correlation between the radio and the Fermi TS map is extremely bad, and that you can see at first eye. Then the correlation with thermal X-rays is also extremely bad, and you can see it at first eye. Then it improves slightly with the non-thermal X-rays, and the best template is the S template. And using this template to get the spectrum, here is the spectrum of RCW86 as seen by Fermi, plus the newest Hess points. And the spectral slope of the Fermi is 1.4. So it's extremely hard. And then if you try to summarize and model this remnant, obviously, as Daniel explained, a Wandel model is obviously too simple for RCW86, where you've got three different zones. But let's try to be simple first. So if you model everything from the radio, X-ray, GV, and TV data with one single population, then here is the result of our fit. You need an extremely soft injection spectrum of 2.4. And since we've got an upper limit here, and the Bremsstrahlung start to dominate, it's the green thing, to avoid this, to overshoot our upper limit, we need a very low density of 0.1 per cubic centimeter. So all that doesn't seem reasonable. So let's move on to a two-zone model. The two-zone is you've got one electron population for the radio, and then another for what concerns X-ray and GV and TV. And anyway, we don't correlate with Fermi and Hess do not correlate with the radio emission. So it makes sense not to try to predict the radio data at the same time of the X-rays and the GV and TV gamma rays. In this case, the injection spectrum is 2.2, and the density can be as high as 1 per cubic centimeter. But if you look at the cosmic ray efficiency, the amount of energy that is injected into protons, in all models, whatever the scenario, whatever the origin of the gamma ray signal, anyway, you've got 2%. So you've got a very low efficiency with this very young remnant. And the second very important point is your Emacs. It's about 75 TeV, in this case, 67 TeV. So it's relatively low for a remnant of 1,800 years. So here is a summary of all the young shell type supernova remnants that are detected at GVA and TV energies, at TV energies. Two of them are not yet detected by Fermi. So you see all their SEDs in comparison to W44, for which we are sure that we have protons accelerated and interaction with a molecular cloud. So clearly, the luminosity is not the same, the spectral shape is not the same, but for all this young shell type, they share the same gamma ray luminosity. So this points towards the same physical scenario. And since RXJ2013 has been well studied, and most people think it's leptonic dominated, then for all of them, you would need the same seed photons for inverse Compton. But you don't have the same density, you don't have the same supernova, you don't have, for SN106, you don't have the same morphology, you've got a bipolar morphology. So that's really interesting that even though they are all different, the location is extremely different, you've got the same gamma ray luminosity. So it seems that it's leptonic dominated, but protons might play a very important role, at least in some regions of the supernova remnant. And that's my point with RXJ2013. So I won't cover that much because it was already discussed in other talks of this conference, but it's very famous, very bright at TV energies. There are lots of models, very complete, of this source showing that we can predict the wall data using a leptonic model. But there is a recent analysis that has been done by the ZS collaboration and presented at the last ICRC, looking at the radial profile. So you look at the radial profile in this region 1 and in this region 3, and you compare with the X-ray. So the X-ray emission is in red, while the Hess emission is in black. And in this region 1, the XMM extent and the Hess extent agree pretty well. Whereas in this region 3, the Hess extent and the S extent is here, the XMM extent is there. So there is a clear disagreement between this, the extent of these two. So there is two ways to explain why the Hess emission goes further in comparison to the X-ray. The first is with particle escape. So you would have protons accelerated in RXJ2013, but you don't have matter, so you don't see them. So they are accelerated, and then they escape. They escape in a region here where you've got dense clouds, and they would emit gamma rays by interacting, by proton-proton interaction, and they would emit gamma rays. And that's why we would see gamma rays where we don't see X-rays. And there is an excellent poster about this scenario, and I encourage you to have a look. The second solution is a B field, a magnetic field evolution. You can also have the magnetic field that drops fastly after the shock. And then if you don't have magnetic field, you don't have synchrotron emission, although you still have your electrons, and they can still emit inverse Compton scattering gamma ray emission. So that's really interesting for the future. Another interesting target in this context of particles escape is SJ2031. I don't have the time to cover this one, but here you've got an unidentified source close to SJ2031. This unidentified SJ2029 is located right at the position of a dense H2 cloud, and it could be that protons accelerated by SJ2031 interact and produce the gamma ray emission that we see. There is a poster on this scenario. I don't have the time to cover it more. So just a word about the historical supernova remnant Cassie and Tycho. It was already reviewed by Amanda during this morning. Just want to say a word about it because it's puzzling. First, just a word about the supernova remnant Cassie. So there is a clear detection at GV and TV energies. There is a clear PAM bump that rules out the Bremsstrahlung for Cas A, but it's even more clear now with the new Cas A data, with the new Fermi data with PAS 8. So that's really interesting, but for this one, the maximum energy is only 10 TeV, and the cosmic ray energy is only 410 to 49 erg, although there is some controversial thing that it might be even higher. So just a word about Tycho now. So this morning, Amanda presented this new plot. Just wanted to advertise that the latest Fermi analysis of Tycho shows this spectrum with the latest Verita spectrum. So you see that the origin of the gamma ray signal seen for Tycho is really uncertain, and I'm not sure that we can claim that the leptonic scenario is completely ruled out so far. So some first thoughts to finalize. We've got the final proof that protons are accelerating supernova remnants. It's clear in supernova remnants interacting with molecular clouds. It's plausible in young non-thermal supernova remnants, and it's clear in very spherical supernova Cas A. But for all of them, as you've seen, the acceleration efficiency is quite low, and we're far from the smoking gun for PV galactic cosmic rays. I'd like just to mention that maybe we are looking for pivotrons, and that's not realistic, because if we assume that we've got three supernova per century, and pivotrons and supernova remnants are pivotrons for 10 to 100 years, as we can see in some publications, then you will have only three pivotrons in the whole galaxy, and they will be very distant. But if you look at escape protons from this source, then you should see gamma rays surrounding these pivotrons for a much longer time. So the emission from the clouds is much weaker, that's for sure, but it lasts longer. So you enhance the probability of detection. And for that, CTA will be very, very well suited. So I will stop there with these very nice perspectives at gamma ray energies. And I would like to thank all the organizers for this very nice conference and my collaborators in the Fermi Hess collaboration and in Bordeaux. And thank you for your attention.
Well, we have time for some questions. There must be questions. While you're thinking, I had a question about the RCW 86-2 zone model. Did the zones have the same volume?
Yeah, it's just, it's not really two zones, it's two particles, it's two population of electrons. But so they are exactly in the same zone, but we try to reproduce the radio data with one population in the whole remnant.
Yeah, but one has a higher magnetic field than the other. So
that's just, you're right. They are exactly the same volume factor, but we didn't try to really reproduce where the radio emission is produced and where the X-ray and TV emission is produced. It's just trying to reproduce the overall flux.
Right.
You're right.
Question? Good.
Thanks, very nice talk. I was wondering, you made the argument that for our young supernova remnants, the intrinsic luminosity is sort of quite similar for all of them. And then you said, well, still, it's hard to understand because the photon density versus inverse comet may be quite different and so on and so forth. And then you made the argument maybe protons could play an important role. But I mean, also for protons, the environment is quite different. The evolutionary stage of the remnants is probably a bit different. So a universal law to make the total gamma ray luminosity sort of very similar for these remnants. Do you have good ideas on this? I mean, I would be curious to learn.
Oh, I don't think there is any analysis about this so far, but that's very interesting. But I'm not aware of any on anything like this so far.
Marianne, just for with regard to the efficiencies that you said were typically are almost all less than 10%. I know that for the modeling that we did on Tycho, it was in the 20s. I don't know what everybody else gets, but that's certainly a discrepancy from the scenario that it would be that low.
So for Tycho, you're meaning that the cosmic ray efficiency would be a higher?
That the instantaneous fraction of the kinetic energy crossing the shock that's being converted into cosmic rays is more into the 20% level.
Uh-huh. That's interesting. Thanks for the comment.
Hi. Yeah, I had a couple of comments on that too. So you talked about CASA, and you said the efficiencies were 2% or something?
Yeah.
But the point is that that's because you're counting it as a fraction of 10 to the 51 Earths. But CASA is still in the ejector-dominated phase. It's going in a wind. 10 to the 51 Earths is not even available for the remnant to actually accelerate. You're probably accelerating only up to like a few times 10 to the 50 at most. So the efficiencies may be higher instantaneously at the moment, but they are not 2%.
Yeah, I agree completely. These are two simple models that take into account the complete evolution of the supernova remnant.
No, that's different. But this, the number you get is okay. It's just not that you're dividing it by 10 to the 51, which is why you're getting the 2%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which is, also, I had a comment on the RxJ1713. Can we go there? And I was just wondering, so you said the X-rays are always inside the gamma ray emission. The X-ray emission is...
It's most with the SPSF.
It's inside the gamma ray emission,
yeah,
right?
It is inside.
So this is going in a very low-density medium, if I understand correctly, so, RxJ1713.
So for this scenario, we explain it saying that here you've got a very low density, and that's why even though you've got protons escaping, they don't emit gamma rays, while in this region, you've got protons that escape in a very dense medium and producing gamma rays.
No, but couldn't the X-ray emission just be coming from the reverse shock ejector and not at all from the forward shock?
No, I don't think so, no.
Why not?
It's non-thermal, don't forget.
Oh, it's all non-thermal.
Yeah.
Okay. That would mean something special for the reverse shock.
Yes.
Okay, very interesting talk. So you talk about the cosmic ray acceleration efficiency. So if you consider the dynamical evolution of the remnant and also the particle could escape from the remnant, would you expect that the cosmic ray acceleration efficiency would also change with time?
Sure. The cosmic ray efficiency should evolve with time depending on the environment that you have. So it should change, sure. But this is not taken into account in our model.
Okay, so maybe it's interesting to check maybe the cosmic ray acceleration efficiency for different remnants in different environment and a different phase, I think.
Yeah, you're right.
Any other questions or comments? Dan.
So Marianne, so that result from IC443 where you subdivided it in four regions, which I think it's an amazing result and super interesting. I've always been curious about this, and I'm not sure anyone has a good answer to it, but I'm going to put you on the spot. The break seems to be approximately at the same place as you mentioned. The way we understand the emission from IC443 is that we think it might come from reacceleration of pre-existing cosmic rays, and the break is a result of that process. However, how can it be that the break is at the same position for material that seems to be in very different regions of a very different... with very different properties?
You're making an excellent point, and that's what I wanted to say. That's really an amazing result, because we've got varying environment, we've got very dense clouds, and part of the remnant that where the environment is very tenuous, but we've got the same spectral shape. And reconciling everything and reconciling the break is extremely hard with such precision. So, yeah, I don't have an answer, but you're making a very, very good point.
Okay, I think it's time to move on. Thank you, Marianne.